Chapter 16. It was one of those little ceremonies so beloved by the TV newsreels. Hatfield and all his staff were gathered in a tight group at the edge of the clearing, with the domes of Port Lowell rising behind them. It was, thought the cameraman, a nicely composed picture, though the constantly changing double illumination made things a little difficult. He got the cue from the control room and started to pan from left to right to give the viewers a bit of movement before the real business began. Not that there was really much to see. The landscape was so flat, and they'd miss all its interest in this monochrome transmission. One couldn't afford the bandwidth for color on a live transmission all the way to Earth. Even on black and white, it was none too easy. He had just finished exploring the scene when he got the order to swing back to Hatfield, who was now making a little speech. That was going out on the other sound channel, and he couldn't hear it, though in the control room it would be mated to the picture he was sending. Anyway, he knew just what the chief would be saying. He'd heard it all before. Mayor Whittaker handed over the shovel on which he had been gracefully leaning for the last 5 minutes, and Hatfield began to tip in the sand until he had covered the roots of the tall, drab Martian plant standing there, held upright in its wooden frame. The air weed, as it was now universally called, was not a very impressive object. It scarcely looked strong enough to stand upright, even under this low gravity. It certainly didn't look as if it could control the future of a planet. Hatfield had finished his token gardening. Someone else could complete the job and fill in the hole. The planting team was already hovering in the background, waiting for the bigwigs to clear out of the way so that they could get on with their work. There was a lot of handshaking and backslapping. Hatfield was hidden by the crowd that had gathered round him. The only person who wasn't taking the slightest notice of all this was Gibson's pet Martian, who was rocking on his haunches like one of those weighted dolls that always come the same way up, however you put them down. The cameraman swung towards him and zoomed to a close-up. It would be the first time anyone on Earth would have seen a real Martian, at least in a live program like this. Hello, what was he up to? Something had caught his interest. The twitching of those huge, membranous ears gave him away. He was beginning to move in short, cautious hops. The cameraman chased him and widened the field at the same time to see where he was going. No one else had noticed that he'd begun to move. Gibson was still talking to Whittaker and seemed to have completely forgotten his pet. So that was the game. This was going to be good. The folk back on Earth would love it. Would he get there before he was spotted? Yes, he'd made it. With one final bound, he hopped down into the little pit, and the small triangular beak began to nibble at the slim Martian plant that had just been placed there with such care. No doubt he thought it so kind of his friends to go to all this trouble for him. Or did he really know he was being naughty? That devious approach had been so skillful that it was hard to believe it was done in complete innocence. Anyway, the cameraman wasn't going to spoil his fun. It would make too good a picture. He cut for a moment back to Hatfield and company, still congratulating themselves on the work which Squeak was rapidly undoing. It was too good to last. Gibson spotted what was happening and gave a great yell which made everyone jump. Then he raced towards Squeak, who did a quick look round, decided that there was nowhere to hide, and just sat still with an air of injured innocence. He let himself be led quietly away, not aggravating his offense by resisting the forces of the law when Gibson grabbed one of his ears and tugged him away from the scene of the crime. A group of experts then gathered anxiously around the airweed, and to everyone's relief, it was soon decided that the damage was not fatal. It was a trivial incident, which no one would have imagined to have any consequences beyond the immediate moment. Yet, though he never realized the fact, it was to inspire one of Gibson's most brilliant and fruitful ideas. Life for Martin Gibson had suddenly become very complicated and intensely interesting. He had been one of the first to see Hatfield after the inception of Project Dawn. The CE had called for him, but had been able to give him only a few minutes of his time. That, however, had been enough to change the pattern of Gibson's future. "I'm sorry I had to keep you waiting," Hatfield said, "but I got the reply from Earth only just before I left. The answer is that you can stay here if you can be absorbed into our administrative structure, to use the official jargon. As the future of our administrative structure depended somewhat largely on Project Dawn, I thought it best to leave the matter until I got back home. The weight of uncertainty had lifted from Gibson's mind. It was all settled now. Even if he had to make a mistake, and he did not believe he had, there was now no going back. He had thrown in his lot with Mars. He would be part of the colony in its fight to regenerate this world that was now stirring sluggishly in its sleep. "And what job have you got for me?" Gibson asked a little anxiously. "I've decided to regularize your unofficial status," said Hadfield with a smile. "What do you mean? Do you remember what I said at our very first meeting? I asked you to help us by giving Earth not the mere facts of the situation, but also some idea of our goals, and I suppose you could call it the spirit we've built up here on Mars. You've done well, despite the fact that you didn't know about the project on which we'd set our greatest hopes. I'm sorry I had to keep Dawn from you, but it would have made your job much harder if you'd known our secret and weren't able to say anything. Don't you agree?" Gibson had not thought of it in that light, but it certainly made sense. "I've been very interested," Hadfield continued, "to see what result your broadcasts and articles have had. You may not know that we've got a delicate method of testing this." "How?" asked Gibson in surprise. "Can't you guess? Every week about 10,000 people, scattered all over Earth, decide they want to come here, and something like 3% pass the preliminary tests. Since your articles started appearing regularly, that figure's gone up to 15,000 a week, and it's still rising." "Oh," said Gibson very thoughtfully. He gave an abrupt little laugh. "I also seem to remember," he added, "that you didn't want me to come here in the first place." "We all make mistakes, but I've learned to profit by mine," smiled Hadfield. "To sum it all up, what I'd like you to do is to lead a small section which, frankly, will be our propaganda department. Of course, we'll think of a nicer name for it. Your job will be to sell Mars. The opportunities are far greater now that we've really got something to put in our shop window. If we can get enough people clamoring to come here, then Earth will be forced to provide the shipping space. And the quicker that's done, the sooner we can promise Earth we'll be standing on our own feet. What do you say?" Gibson felt a fleeting disappointment. Looked at from one point of view, this wasn't much of a change. But the CE was right. He could be of greater use to Mars in this way than in any other. "I can do it," he said. "Give me a week to sort out my terrestrial affairs and clear up my outstanding commitments." A week was somewhat optimistic, he thought, but that should break the back of the job. He wondered what Ruth was going to say. She'd probably think he was mad, and she'd probably be right. "The news that you're going to stay here," said Hadfield with satisfaction, "will cause a lot of interest and will be quite a boost to our campaign. You've no objection to our announcing it right away?" "I don't think so." "Good. Whittaker would like to have a word with you now about the detailed arrangements. You realize, of course, that your salary will be that of a Class II administrative officer of your age?" "Naturally, I've looked into that," said Gibson. He did not add, because it was unnecessary, that this was largely of theoretical interest. His salary on Mars, though less than a tenth of his total income, would be quite adequate for a comfortable standard of living on a planet where there were very few luxuries. He was not sure just how he could use his terrestrial credits, but no doubt they could be employed to squeeze something through the shipping bottleneck. After a long session with Whittaker, who nearly succeeded in destroying his enthusiasm with laments about lack of staff and accommodation, Gibson spent the rest of the day writing dozens of radiograms. The longest was to Ruth, and was chiefly, but by no means wholly, concerned with business affairs. Ruth had often commented on the startling variety of things she did for her 10%, and Gibson wondered what she was going to say to this request that she keep an eye on one James Spencer, and generally look after him when he was in New York, which, since he was completing his studies at MIT, might be fairly often. It would have made matters much simpler if he could have told her the facts. She would probably guess them anyway. But that would be unfair to Jimmy. Gibson had made up his mind that he would be the first to know. There were times when the strain of not telling him was so great that he felt almost glad they would soon be parting. Yet Hatfield, as usual, had been right. He had waited a generation. He must wait a little longer yet. To reveal himself now might leave Jimmy confused and hurt, might even cause the breakdown of his engagement to Irene. The time to tell him would be when they had been married and, Gibson hoped, were still insulated from any shocks which the outside world might administer. It was ironic that, having found his son so late, he must now lose him again. Perhaps that was part of the punishment for the selfishness and lack of courage, to put it no more strongly, he had shown 20 years ago. But the past must bury itself. He must think of the future now. Jimmy would return to Mars as soon as he could. There was no doubt of that. And even if he had missed the pride and satisfaction of parenthood, there might be compensations later in watching his grandchildren come into the world he was helping to remake. For the first time in his life, Gibson had a future to which he could look forward with interest and excitement, a future which would not be merely a repetition of the past. Earth hurled its thunderbolt 4 days later. The first Gibson knew about it was when he saw the headline across the front page of the Martian Times. For a moment, the two words staring back at him were so astounding that he forgot to read on. Hadfield recalled. We have just received news that the Interplanetary Development Board has requested the chief executive to return to Earth on the Ares, which leaves Deimos in 4 days. No reason is given. That was all. But it would set Mars ablaze. No reason was given, and none was necessary. Everyone knew exactly why Earth wanted to see Warren Hadfield. What do you think of this? Gibson asked Jimmy as he passed the paper across the breakfast table. "Good Lord!" gasped Jimmy. "There'll be trouble now. What do you think he'll do?" "What can he do?" "Well, he can refuse to go. Everyone here would certainly back him up." "That would only make matters worse. He'll go, all right. Hadfield isn't the sort of man to run away from a fight." Jimmy's eyes suddenly brightened.
"That means that Irene will be going, too."
"Trust you to think of that," laughed Gibson. "I suppose you hope it will be an ill wind blowing the pair of you some good, but don't count on it. Hadfield might leave Irene behind." He thought this very unlikely. When the chief returned, he would need all the moral support he could get. Despite the amount of work he had awaiting him, Gibson paid one brief call to admin, where he found everyone in a state of mingled indignation and suspense. Indignation because of Earth's cavalier treatment of the chief. Suspense because no one yet knew what action he was going to take. Hadfield had arrived early that morning, and so far had not seen anyone except Whittaker and his private secretary. Those who had caught a glimpse of him stated that for a man who was, technically, about to be recalled in disgrace, he looked remarkably cheerful. Gibson was thinking over this news as he made a detour towards the biology lab. He had missed seeing his little Martian friend for 2 days, and felt rather guilty about it. As he walked slowly along Regent Street, he wondered what sort of defense Hadfield would be able to put up. Now he understood that remark that Jimmy had overheard. Would success excuse everything? Success was still a long way off. As Hadfield had said, to bring Project Dawn to its conclusion would take half a century, even assuming the maximum assistance from Earth. It was essential to secure that support, and Hadfield would do his utmost not to antagonize the home planet. The best that Gibson could do to support him would be to provide long-range covering fire from his propaganda department. Squeak, as usual, was delighted to see him, though Gibson returned his greeting somewhat absent-mindedly. As he invariably did, he proffered Squeak a fragment of airweed from the supply kept in the lab. That simple action must have triggered something in his subconscious mind, for he suddenly paused, then turned to the chief biologist. "I've just had a wonderful idea," he said. "You know you were telling me about the tricks you've been able to teach Squeak?"
"Teach him. The problem now is to stop him learning them."
"You also said you were fairly sure that Martians could communicate with each other, didn't you?"
Well, our field parties proved that they can pass on simple thoughts and even some abstract ideas like color. That doesn't prove much, of course. Bees can do the same. Then tell me what you think of this. Why shouldn't we teach them to cultivate the air we eat for us? You see what a colossal advantage they've got. They can go anywhere on Mars they please, while we'd have to do everything with machines. They needn't know what they're doing, of course. We'd simply provide them with the shoots. It does propagate that way, doesn't it? Teach them the necessary routine and reward them afterwards. Just a moment. It's a pretty idea, but haven't you overlooked some practical points? I think we could train them in the way you suggest. We've certainly learned enough about their psychology for that. But may I point out that there are only 10 known specimens, including Squeak?
I hadn't overlooked that, said Gibson impatiently. I simply don't believe the group I found is the only one in existence. That would be a quite incredible coincidence. Certainly they're rather rare, but there must be hundreds, if not thousands, of them over the planet. I'm going to suggest a photo reconnaissance of all the airweed forests. We should have no difficulty in spotting their clearings. But in any case, I'm taking the long-term view. Now that they've got far more favorable living conditions, they'll start to multiply rapidly, just as the Martian plant life's already doing. Remember, even if we left it to itself, the airweed would cover the equatorial regions in 400 years, according to your own figures. With the Martians and us to help it spread, we might cut ears off Project Dawn. The biologist shook his head doubtfully, but began to do some calculations on a scribbling pad. When he had finished, he pursed his lips. Well, he said, I can't actually prove it's impossible. There are too many unknown factors, including the most important one of all, the Martians' reproduction rate. Incidentally, I suppose you know that they're marsupials. That's just been confirmed.
You mean like kangaroos?
Yes. Junior lives undercover until he's a big enough boy to go out into the cold, hard world. We think several of the females are carrying babies, so they may reproduce yearly. And since Squeak was the only infant we found, that means they must have a terrifically high death rate, which isn't surprising in this climate.
Just the conditions we want, exclaimed Gibson. Now there'll be nothing to stop them multiplying, providing we see they get all the food they need.
Do you want to breed Martians or cultivate airweed? Challenged the biologist.
Both, grinned Gibson. They go together like fish and chips or ham and eggs.
Don't, pleaded the other, with such a depth of feeling that Gibson apologized at once for his lack of tact. He had forgotten that no one on Mars had tasted such things for years. The more Gibson thought about his new idea, the more it appealed to him. Despite the pressure of his personal affairs, he found time to write a memorandum to Hadfield on the subject and hoped that the CE would be able to discuss it with him before returning to Earth. There was something inspiring about the thought of regenerating not only a world, but also a race which might be older than man. Gibson wondered how the changed climatic conditions of 100 years hence would affect the Martians. If it became too warm for them, they could easily migrate north or south, if necessary, into the subpolar regions where Phobos was never visible. As for the oxygenated atmosphere, they had been used to that in the past and might adapt themselves to it again. There was considerable evidence that Squeak now obtained much of his oxygen from the air in Port Lowell and seemed to be thriving on it. There was still no answer to the great question which the discovery of the Martians had raised. Were they the degenerate survivors of a race which had achieved civilization long ago and let it slip from its grasp when conditions became too severe? This was the romantic view, for which there was no evidence at all. The scientists were unanimous in believing that there had never been any advanced culture on Mars, but they had been proved wrong once and might be so again. In any case, it would be an extremely interesting experiment to see how far up the evolutionary ladder the Martians would climb now that their world was blossoming again. For it was their world, not man's. However he might shape it for his own purposes, it would be his duty always to safeguard the interests of its rightful owners. No one could tell what part they might have to play in the history of the universe. And when, as was one day inevitable,
man himself came to the notice of yet higher races, he might well be judged by his behavior here on Mars.